Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the appellant petitioner Daniel DeFore. Barbara DeFore's election to claim an elective share of her deceased husband's augmented estate was erroneously dismissed by the probate court, and petitioner respectfully requests that this court order it reinstated. The procedural history of this case is important to this issue. On August 23, 2017, William DeFore died. On October 4, 2017, Barbara DeFore, the surviving spouse, was given notice by the personal representative as that as surviving spouse, Barbara had the right to take an elective share as provided under Minnesota Statute 554.2. Barbara was informed of the timing in which she had to make such an election. What followed that was 8 days later was a document filed with the probate court entitled Written Statement of the Claim, where Barbara asserted the estate is or will be indebted to her pursuant to Minnesota Statute 524.2-202 for an elective share, including a supplemental elective share. Respondent Wood, as well as the probate court, understood by the filing of this document Barbara was exercising her right to take an elective share and was requesting.
Do you agree, counsel, that the written statement of claims does not technically qualify as a petition under the statute, given the definition of petition?
The written statement of the claim does, it does not say it's a petition. But in the context and what is said in it, it's clear that she's exercising her right, because when you're stating a claim, you're stating the amount claim and asking that the personal representative to pay it. And that's not what the written statement of claim does either. And so when you read it in context, what she was doing was, with a petition, exercising her right, and then as everyone understood by this document, she was requesting that the court would order her a share of an augmented estate.
I have a question for you about the apparent change in this, well, not apparent, the change in the statutory language from the time of Krugel. In fact, at the time of Krugel, the statute was being changed, and it regards the idea of the district court's discretion on the question of an equitable relief of the deadline for the filing of the petition. The statute in Krugel says something to the effect of the a claimant may file a petition, et cetera, in order to make the spousal election. And since that time, the statute has changed to include several times the word must. Except as provided in paragraph B, the election must be made by filing and mailing and delivering of a petition for elective share within, and it gives the dates, and must give notice of the time and place of the hearing. So I'm wondering what your position is, assuming, I'm not convinced that Krugel applies to this case, but assuming it did, whether there's any room anymore for the district court to have this equitable relief of the deadline.
Well, first of all, we're not asking for equitable relief of the deadline. It is our position we met the deadline, that we filed this document, and that...
I understand that. The district court, though, did take this approach of looking at Krugel and analyzing equitable relief.
Correct, and the district court's approach is wrong, because there's a real distinction between a situation where you have filed no document and that where you are filing late.
Right. Now, I get that argument, and I'll talk to your opponent on that distinction, but on this question of the status of the law.
I don't see that there is a change, because the probate code statute still provides that it's to be liberally construed. That hasn't changed. And the fact is that you have here a document filed by which she's making an elective share, and there's no question that notice was provided of the hearing. In fact, respondent Wood actually requested that the hearing be continued. So there really isn't any real issue here.
The respondent Wood, Mrs. Wood, not Mr. Wood.
Mr. Wood, and with regard
to Mr. Wood?
Pardon me?
I thought it was Ms. Wood that asked for the continuance.
That's correct.
Not Mr. Wood.
Correct, not Mr. Wood. But as with regard to Mr. Wood, the fact of the matter is, as the court is well aware, there hasn't been a hearing yet. The statute doesn't provide any time frame in which you must give notice of the hearing. I mean, you have to, under the statute, if you give 14 days before the hearing, but as long as there has not been a hearing, that this can easily be remedied on remand with a notice provided to Mr. Wood as well.
Am I correct that at the time of the document filing, this statement of claim in, what was it, October of 2017, at that time the court, there was no personal representative at that time. There was a competing request for appointment as personal representative. But was there a personal representative at that time?
I can't remember. It was close. It might have been right after that that there were competing. I'd have to go back.
It was all within about a week or so. You've got these competing petitions. But was there an appointment? The district court hadn't acted on any of the requests to be appointed as personal representative.
Well, there was a stipulation eventually that Daniel would be the personal representative, and exactly the time frame, it should be in my appellant's brief, is exactly the time frame on that.
I thought the district, okay, so I think the district court appointed a personal representative in, if I'm right, in November 2017. And your client filed the statement in October of 2017, I believe. Is that consistent with your recollection?
My recollection is, let me just see, that I really wasn't looking at the timing of that.
Well, you don't have to take your time to dig
right.
in the brief
I
to find the answer.
I will go back and look. Well, because you had the
But just as a matter of law, though, a matter of procedure, before the district court appointed a personal representative, assume I'm correct that it was in November of 2017, November 7th, what was the status of whether there was a personal representative?
No, that's incorrect, that Mr. DeFore was appointed personal representative before the notice because it was the personal representative that sent the notice to Barbara that of the need to make her election. So what you have is she was notified on October 4th, 2017 by the personal representative, excuse me, and that was Mr. DeFore. So that's the timing.
Okay, so I must be mistaken. I thought it was in November of 2017 that the district court probated the will and appointed a personal representative.
There was a stipulation, though, before that.
Okay.
But I'm relatively certain from the record.
The reason I ask that is I just, as I read the statute, an election is made. And that's what's going on here. The question is, was an election made? And there's a prerequisite. The election must be made by filing in the court and mailing or delivering to the personal representative, if any, a petition for the elective share within the nine-month period. And so the reason I'm asking, if there was no personal representative at the time, then it would seem to me that the statutory prerequisite is met. There was a filing with the court. If there was no personal representative, there's no obligation in the perfection making of the election to serve it on a personal representative. But if there was a personal representative, it seems to me that the election has not been made unless there was service on the personal representative.
And there's no issue with regard to the personal representative.
Why not, though? Because I thought I saw that the district court said that there was this filing, but there was no affidavit of service. with the filing of the statement of claims.
There may have been no affidavit of service, but the personal representative was given notice. The personal representative is not asserted that there was not the compliance with the statute as far as the personal representative is concerned.
Okay, so there was a, you're saying either there was a mailing or delivering to the personal representative, or if there wasn't, that issue is waived.
Correct.
Okay.
There is not an issue there. And it's, the respondent has argued that there's supposed to be this service like on the woods, but that's not the case under the statute. I mean, it's only, it's to be filed and then as to the personal representative. So what we have here is a situation where this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court is seen in a wide variety of situations where you have a issue of the statutory initiation of a claim. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has long committed to the proposition that technical or formal defects which have not misled or prejudiced an adverse party are to be disregarded. You cannot find on this record that the respondent Woods were misled or prejudiced and that any defects have not affected the respondent's substantial rights. A prime example of a case like this situation is the case of Peterson versus Marston, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court cases at 362 Northwest 2nd at 309. In that case, you had a letter was written to the attorney for the estate, and the issue was whether that letter was a valid claim for payment from the estate. The probate court said no, the letter didn't demand payment, it found no intent to make a claim, it was an inquiry letter. Both this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed, recognized that the provisions of the code are to be liberally construed. Although the letter did not explicitly demand payment, in the context as a whole, the Supreme Court concluded the inquiry about what to do was evidence of present intent to make a claim. Of importance to the Supreme Court was the fact that the letter was expressly written in response to a published notice to make a claim, and by writing to the attorney, they were acting with the intent to protect their right. And the Minnesota Supreme Court focused on the fact that as long as the estate received reasonable notice by the required time, it was legally sufficient. That's why it's important to look at timing here. Here we have the written statement of claim. It follows like 8 days after Barbara is told of the need to make an election and the timing in which to do so. Everyone connected with the litigation thereafter understood exactly what this was. It was an election, and it was to ask the court to order the augmented estate. And that's what the whole trial was set for. That's what the discovery conducted was on. And so there is no basis under Minnesota law, as construed by the Minnesota Supreme Court, in regard to the liberal construction, with regard to ignoring any technical and defects which do not affect the rights of the parties. And so we ask that this court reverse and reinstate this claim.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This appeal is solely over.
Your name, please?
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Thomas K. Cambry, C-A-M-B-R-E, representing the respondent, Lori Wood. So this case is solely over the claimed election of the elective share. I would just emphasize that the operative statute in this matter, section 524.2-211, does use mandatory language. The election must be made by filing a petition within 9 months after the date of the decedent's death.
Can I focus on a couple of things that seem to trouble me about this case? One is that the district court and your brief seems to focus, in fact, your brief suggests that Krugel mirrors this case. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Krugel dealt with an entirely different issue, which was whether an untimely petition, the district court's power to reject an untimely petition for an elective share, an undisputedly petition for an elective share. In this case, it seems to me the question is whether a pleading, which was timely under this statute, was in fact a petition for the spousal elective share. Am I correct that that it distinguishes this case from Krugel?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So your brief and the district court seem to focus on this as a concern that whether Mr. Wood was served, whether Mr. Wood got notice. But as I read the statute, you can disabuse me if you think I'm wrong on the reading, there are separate requirements. One is the requirement that perfects the petition, that perfects the election for the spousal share. The other is notice to all affected parties as to when the hearing is going to take place. So in this case, wasn't there notice? Wasn't the claim, whatever you want to call it, treated by the district court, by the parties, by everyone involved as effectively a petition?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor, but if we're focusing on Mr. Wood, I would just point out, as referenced in his affidavit, he's been self-represented throughout.
Okay, so let's assume that why is that a problem? If the hearing hasn't occurred yet, if what he needs to get notice of is when the hearing occurs so he can participate in the hearing, why does that matter to whether or not Barbara DeFore perfected her interest in a spousal share?
He's an interested party. He's got a 50% interest in the financial account, which is the nexus or the nub of this litigation.
Right, so he can fight at the hearing and defend his interest, the hearing which hasn't occurred yet. Are you suggesting, it seemed to me in your brief, and it seems to me the district court took the view that at the time of the filing of the petition, there was then the requirement to give some notice or service to the interested parties, not just the filing with the court and the mailing to the personal representative. Is that your position?
Yes.
Where in the statute do you derive that conclusion? What is the language that gets you there?
The surviving spouse must give notice of the time and place for hearing to persons interested in the estate.
Right, that's a requirement. But what in the statute indicates that that is a requirement for the making of a request for the elective share?
Well, just to bring, again, getting back to one of the founding principles of the Uniform Probate Act, to bring a speedy and efficient adjudication to claims.
Well, at the time of the filing, there was no date. There was no hearing date. There was no hearing place set. Let me read the first sentence, and I'm just going to read it unembellished. Except as provided in paragraph B, the election must be made by filing in the court and mailing or delivering to the personal representative, if any, a petition for the elective share within, and then it gives the dates and requirements of the dates, period. That's what the statute says is required for the making of this petition. And it seems to me that was done here. The court treated it that way. The court set a hearing date. The court set discovery. The parties engaged in discovery. It seems like everybody involved treated this as this petition. Am I correct about that, at least? Do you disagree about that?
The motion to dismiss the action was brought when the discrepancy was discovered.
Right, but up until that time, for the 2 years before that time, Do you agree that the district court treated the filing in all respects as a petition, and the parties, your client included, treated that filing as a petition?
That was the understanding, I presume, of the court, yes.
Okay, so address Ms. Hunt's argument of form over substance. If everyone involved treated this as doing the thing that is done with an actual petition, and the real difference is whether the term petition or claim is used, why isn't this effectively a form over substance argument that the district court relied upon in rejecting the claim as a petition?
Well, appellant goes to great lengths to make arguments that form should not be exalted over substance. Long litany of cases are cited to support that premise, but all of those cases are inapposite to the present case. But I would submit, Your Honor, that in...
By the way, I would agree with you, because in this case, everyone actually treated this document as an operative document. Those cases don't even go that far. So in that sense, I think you're right.
But to make an argument that form should not be exalted over substance is essentially, I would submit, making arguing for equity, in arguing for justice administered according to fairness, as contrasted with strictly formulated rules of common law or statutory law. The Supreme Court in the Krugel case said that equitable considerations could be raised in matters of determining whether the elective share were timely filed or not. The Supreme Court in Krugel found, quote, it is for the trial court to determine in the exercise of its discretion whether such equitable considerations exist.
But we're not talking about an equitable relief of a deadline here. We're talking about whether a document effectively does what the statute asks the document to do, which is to alert the personal representative and the court about a request for a spousal share so that the case can be tried, the issue can be resolved, how much of a share is the spouse entitled to, and discovery begins and a trial date is set and the parties get ramped up and ready to go on the question. And that's exactly what happened here for 2 years.
I think it's still an equitable argument. The statute reads clearly one thing. Appellants went down a completely different avenue with the claim. These are totally
okay,
different.
Okay, when you say sections. The statute reads differently, the statute doesn't actually say what the words have to be. It doesn't say it has to be captioned as a petition. It says you file a petition. In this case, they called it a claim. Am I correct that that's really the heart of your argument and the district court's decision, that the caption is really what drives it?
No. There's the substance. And again, the elective share has its own body of statutory focus in Article 2, Part 2 of the Probate Code, whereas claims are governed under Article 3, Part 8 of the Code. Totally different focuses.
But in your brief, you note that the focus of the litigation in probate court was wife's elective share. So wasn't it everyone's understanding, including including respondents' understanding, that the statement of claim, I think it was the written statement of claims, was in effect a petition? And if you look at the wording of it, it certainly, you know, reflects, it says, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 524.2-202, I'm looking at ADD, addendum page 4, but it says, estate is or will become indebted to me as follows, and then it says, pursuant to the statute, my elective share. So how is that not clearly a request for an elective share or a petition within the meaning of the statute?
Well, claims as defined by the statute don't cover the elective share.
Claims. Correct. But the language of that, and so maybe claim was a misstatement, but the rest of the language makes it clear that it's a petition or a request for an elective share.
Which, again, was never served upon Mr. Wood, an interested party to this matter.
Well, that gets back to my original point, that the first sentence requires the perfection of the elective share to occur by filing and with the court and service on the personal representative, or delivery, not necessarily service, but delivery or mailing to the personal representative. And then a separate requirement for notice to anybody who needs to participate in the hearing after a hearing has been set. Would you agree with me that no hearing date had been set at the time of the filing of this document?
That is, I believe, correct.
How is it that the document cannot be perfect unless Mr. Wood is notified of the hearing date?
But was never notified at any point throughout this proceeding. He was listed in appellant's witness list a week before the trial, but that's the first time that appellant ever
took. Can't that be remedied since there hasn't been a trial?
I think it would just.
I mean, if I'm correct that it doesn't go, that his lack of notice of the hearing date doesn't go to the perfection of the request for the spousal share. And that seemed, would you agree, that's what the district court was really grappling with, was the request, Barbara DeFore's request for the elective share perfected at the time of the statement of claim?
Well, I think the district court did a good analysis and a good job of identifying the nonconformity of the written statement. I think the district court's reliance upon the Krugel case is well spoken. And again,
why did all of the parties engage as if this was a petition?
Pardon?
Why did all of the parties engage after the filing of the statement of claim as if it were a petition?
I can't speak as to the court.
Well, you can speak as to your client.
I didn't notice the error until after trial was continued. And I don't think there's any estoppel by waiver.
How is focusing on the term claim instead of petition consistent with the statutory directive to liberally construe the obligations of the statute so as to protect the spousal elective share?
I would just submit, Your Honor, that under the Krugel case, there was a result which would be considered harsh for the widow, but still that was the ruling of the Supreme Court.
Well, the ruling of the Supreme Court was pretty narrow, I think, and just directed this court not to substitute its judgment on equitable concerns after the district court has already made a decision not to apply equity to relieve the burden of a deadline. I think that's what Krugel stands for.
Well, I think Krugel stands for a strict adherence to the statutory cutoff, and Krugel stands for a broad discretion given to the district court in matters of equitable consideration.
Can I follow up with one
last
question?
Yes, please do.
What's your best succinct one or two sentence argument for why this is a question of an equitable consideration when we're talking about the construction of a document as to whether it meets the statute or doesn't? Why does equity matter?
Equity matters in that the court was well apprised as to the equities of the claim and the manner in which the litigation proceeded over the months. There were some shenanigans on appellant's side. The district court was apprised of those. The district court...
And that, you mean the, like the letters were sent by you or that you didn't get responses to, that sort of thing?
Exactly. Being, I was named a witness in appellant's witness list 1 week before the trial. The district court was apprised of all of these shenanigans and I think made an appropriate decision that no equitable considerations weighed in to grant any sort of relief from Ms. DeFore's non-compliance with the statute.
Thanks.
Any other questions? No, thank you.
May I take just a few more seconds?
Very, very, very briefly.
As the court knows, the argument on this case was scheduled for February 11th. I had a few days before that date requested a continuance due to a family emergency, and the court granted that request. Obviously, we're here today. I was able to fly out to California and be at my mother's side when she passed, which was on February 11th, about 2 hours before oral argument was scheduled. So it was a graced moment, and I do want to thank the court and counsel for your flexibility and compassion.
We're sorry for your loss.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Cranberry, I lost my father this year as well, so it was an easy thing for us to accommodate, and we're glad to have done it and regret the circumstances that you faced.
Thank you. It meant the world to me and my family.
When we're talking about a petition, we're talking about someone exercising their right to take an election and seeking the courts going forward and determining that. And that's what we have in this case. All you need to do is look at the objector's statement of the issues at Addendum 25, and it's clear that not only the probate court, but the respondent as well recognized throughout that what we were talking about here is determining the amount of the elective share.
No, Ms. Hunt, you didn't. You came on board in the appeal. You weren't counsel in the trial court.
No, I was not.
I mean, I'm not going to ask you to defend everything that happened in the trial court, but you would recognize that there were, Mr. Cranberry describes them as shenanigans, there were multiple requests to your client's counsel for responses and addressing this very issue of what amount your client was seeking as an elective share, and those weren't responded to. Doesn't the district court have some, in the exercise of its own authority, some basis to remedy what appears to be unfair treatment and delaying tactics?
Not by
negligence?
Not by dismissing a claim for elective share. And with regard to that, I mean, all I can do is speak to what the record says, that counsel for the appellant responded to the respondent's assertions of delay in responding to the motion to dismiss in her affidavit. And you can see from the record that there was, part of the delay was in valuing one of its Prudco. So there was a delay there, but...
I'm talking about just non-responsiveness to requests for positions on the question of the equitable share or the elective share.
Well, all I can speak to is how the appellant's counsel responded to that by affidavit, and that's what the record reflects.
Sure.
But the trial court's basis is certainly not on that, as I read the court's order. The court got confused and moved over into this equity to a situation where you don't have a document filed, where you're not proceeding, which is what the case, the In re Krugel case, concerns. So it really is of no moment to this case. And based on the strong, strong line of cases in Minnesota, in virtually every area from garnishments to probate, that, you know, technical defects don't matter. What matters is the fact that everyone knows what is being proceeded, there's no prejudice to anyone, and that the rights are protected. And I ask that this court reverse and reinstate. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties. And the case is submitted. We'll be issuing a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you both. Oh, the court is in recess. Oh, dear.